bangly bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, Sir Ian McKellen pops in to talk about Mr. Holmes and the Entourage Gang. Drop by to invite us to...
You gotta stop.
That's a great impression of the actors in Entourage.
It's pretty good, isn't it? To hug it out. All that unusual movie news and nonsense on the Movie Podcast was devastated to be overlooked for the Top Gear job. Camshafts, torques, fan belts. Got all the car knowledge just coming out of our astras. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. I was stuck in traffic near Birmingham this morning, but I've made it here by the skin of my teeth. You will be delighted to know, because it means I can inflict, as you've already heard, an endless Ian McKellen impression on you. Joining me this week, two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our resident Jurassic Park expert, a man who knows everything there is to know about Isla Nublar, Isla Sorna, and Isla Sinclair. It's Nick Dissimulian. How are you?
Hello. It can camouflage. I just watched the film again yesterday, and that's the dying line of a character in the film. I just love that he yells out a bit of exposition as he as he hits the ground. But
you watched it again?
I watched it again. I spotted myself this time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I was going to keep going back until I saw myself, and finally I did in 2D. Maybe that helped.
Is that because you can camouflage? So are you in every scene, but just camouflaged?
I am now.
Amazing. So that says Edmund. If anyone doesn't know, Nick, when he visited the set of Jurassic World, was offered a cameo part by the director Colin Trevorrow playing...
Cameo is strong. I know. Extra.
I was going to be in a close-up. I was going to be just behind the kids, but then the AD went, no, we've already shot a scene with the kids, so okay. You have to go right over there where no one will be able to see you. But I'm still very happy.
You're Edmund, a tourist who visits the island, Jurassic World, and then what happens?
Well, his storyline is left very much open for the sequel.
Yeah, okay.
So just wait and see. I can't say anything else.
That's very, very good. That's great news. Someone who isn't in Jurassic World is our geek queen, who this week was very, 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 very happy to know that a Supernatural alum is coming to UK. So expect him to be wrestled into the pod booth, gagged and bound, which might make talking to him difficult. It's not Sam or Dean, though, is it, Helen?
It's
O'Hara?
Not. It's the King of Hell.
The King
played
of Hell.
Played by Mark Shepherd. It would be actually Mark Shepherd and not the King of Hell we'd be inviting in, just to be clear. Now, I just think it'd be, you know, after wanging on about it all these months, perhaps you guys should hear it from
Wang
the horse's
being
mouth.
The operative. Yeah.
Have you actually seen Supernatural? Because I'm just wondering if like, you're just bluffing it all this time.
No, I have totally seen it. Yes, I like it when they stake the vampires and they turn to dust, and also when they fly the vipers through space.
Oh, yeah. And do you remember the episode where they managed a leisure centre and everything went wrong?
There was
a secretary with a baby in the drawer.
Yeah.
That was fun.
And the hotel in Torquay.
Indeed. So who is this? This guy, Mark Shepherd, he plays Crowley, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was in Battlestar Galactica, actually, which is why the vipers came to mind, where he was a lawyer.
Okay, we have just one question this week. This is from at Random River, who asks, who has the best office in film and TV as I'm currently chaining the West Wing? Chaining the West Wing?
I would have said, yeah. It's like chain smoking, I guess.
I'm guessing this is new street slang.
New street slang. Chaining the West Wing.
Get down with the kids, Chris. Come on.
Chain watching. As I'm currently watching the West Wing, I would say Leo McGarry, says Random River.
I mean, Leo has a nice office, but it's quite small. I mean, it's very tasteful, but it doesn't have like majestic views of an entire city or anything. I guess the advantage
is Christian Grey.
Oh no, let's not.
No, that's an office.
Is it?
That's an office. Yeah,
I suppose it is. All right, fine.
I've just got Christian Grey in my mind because we're recording this on the day that Grey, E.L. James's follow-up to. The 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. Like, how much more money do you need?
This is the one released? That leaked last week.
Well,
leaked everywhere.
It leaked everywhere, and then it was released. Finally, it gained its release today.
I saw on Amazon that 50 Shades of Grey, the Blu-ray, is having an early release, which
it's unfortunate.
Is an unfortunate wording, I'd say, for that.
That's never happened to Christian Grey before, so. Stop that with your accusations. Yeah, but that's out today. Kat Brown, formerly of this parish, has been live blogging it for The Telegraph, where she now works. And the standout phrase so far from E.L. James' Grey is, because it's told from Christian Grey's point of view, is, "My cock agrees."
Oh. Yeah, I genuinely think that's his equivalent of my inner goddess did a salsa or whatever the hell her inner goddess does at any given moment. But he seems to have more of a one track, you know.
That's great that it's on the same page. It's important.
It's important to be simpatico.
It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Any more offices?
I like a good sci-fi office. Mm-hmm. I am very fond of Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg's office in The Fifth Element.
What's he got in there?
He has the little magic vacuum cleaner thing, the little robots that come out and a beautiful dancing shoes after a glass is broken. He has a secretary who has a magic machine to do her nail polish. Mm. And Crazy Clothes by Jean-Paul Gaultier. And it's just, you know, it's a little bit interesting. He's got a nice view over an entire city, possibly altitude sickness because it seems to be quite high. But
that's not bad.
That's a pretty good office. That's pretty good.
The very first office that popped into my head was Men in Black. And not just because it sort of was an Apple store before Apple stores were a thing, but it's just stuffed with aliens and just craziness going on at all times.
So like an Apple store.
And I would also put in a shout for Blade Runner's Tyrell's office in Blade Runner. Actually, any of the offices in Blade Runner, they're all really cool. But his in particular, because again, he's got the best view.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So do you like offices, any of the offices in, say, Office Space or Papa Bosses? You know, just like general offices or, you know, cubicles.
No, like I don't like
Neo's cubicle in The Matrix or Billy Pilcher's cubicle in Gremlins 2.
Well, they're meant to be terrible offices, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're not good ones. In terms of good ones, Thank You for Smoking, Rob Lowe's office in that is amazing.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice office.
Koi, pond, all kinds of stuff.
Lots of bamboo and such.
Hudsucker Proxy, Paul Newman's office.
Yep.
Yes.
Sure.
Nice one.
Although I'd maybe go next door to the president's office, which I quite like as well.
Good point.
I mean, because he's got a sofa and definitely a bathroom. We don't see that in Newman's office.
That's a good point.
What's his name? Sidney J. Musburger?
White Goodman's office in Dodgeball. That's an amazing office.
Yes.
And I can't imagine most people who run a gym have such a huge, extravagant office with a gigantic portrait of them on the wall.
Yeah, seizing the bull by the horns.
It's a metaphor.
But it actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
I've got one that actually contributes to the plot of a movie, Jeff Rabin, in Usual Suspects, Dan Hedaya's character, because his office obviously contains everything that Ferbal Kent needs to spin his yarn for the cops, you know, on his whiteboard. Behind him. So yeah,
that's fair.
That's
I love that you can actually buy a Kobayashi white mug online, which is, you would never know what that is because it only says Kobayashi on the bottom. So you'd have to keep showing it to people.
You'd have to keep smashing it, wouldn't you?
You'd have to keep chucking it on the floor.
I'd have to drink it every time I felt I was on the cusp of a revelation and then just, you know, drop it. But and if you have carpet, it's not going to smash. It's a bit convoluted.
Maybe you could just place it on the floor and then point at it so people get the idea.
And little robots could come and tidy it up if you're Zorg. Phil had a suggestion for this. Phil, my brother. It's black and white, obviously. And it is Herr Hinkle's office in The Great Dictator, which is, if you recall, resplendent with a gigantic globe which you can roll around on.
That is actually a beautiful, beautiful office. I would, totally agree with that. That's amazing. Top Secret, I can't remember his name, but the head Nazi's office with the enormous telephone and so on.
Yes.
Is a pretty nice office.
That is a pretty good office.
So maybe that. Yeah. So, Nazis have all the best offices, I guess.
That seems to be the case.
It is going
Nazis
that way.
Nazis and megalomaniacs.
It is going that way. Any great offices this year? Did you like Immortan Joe's office in Fury Road? Did we like Tony Stark's got quite a nice office?
Tony Stark
I
has
guess,
a hell know. Of an office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lack of great offices, I think. I think there's a lot of hate weirdly being thrown Jurassic World's way, and I think mainly it's because there's not a great office in that film.
Yeah, that's probably it.
There's a nice control room, but the lack of an office really angered me as a salaryman, as an office worker.
Yeah, you felt disrespected.
I did feel a little bit disrespected, to be honest. So
there's too much discipline in that control room, isn't there? With all the little dinosaur toys we have in our office, we would get in a lot of trouble, I think, with the authorities there.
So are you talking office discipline? I know, I feel like we should mention secretary.
Yeah.
And we're back to 50 Shades of
Grey.
There you go. And on that bombshell.
Is the Death Star an office?
Is the Death Star an office?
I'd love to just see them doing some photocopying.
It's the Death Star.
Some admin.
Yeah,
there's got to be water coolers. You never see a water cooler, do you, on the Death Star? But
yeah, you never. Yeah.
It's a concern.
You know what I read the other week about something that never appears in Star Wars? And I think offices is definitely one of them. But something else that doesn't appear in Star Wars is
paper. There's no paper at any point in any movie in the Star Wars saga. Maybe J.J. Abrams, with his, you know, his analog approach, will have someone give me that paper. Give me that paper. Walk with me. Yeah, to my office. Maybe that would be a nice scene. If J.J., if you're listening, and I know you are, there's still time to put in a scene where someone has a paper.
You're right. It's all holographic. Then I have to mention, if we're talking about offices, I have to talk about The Office in Disclosure. I love this film. Do you remember this film?
You don't love this film.
Do you really love this film?
It is a film. It is a thriller that climaxes with Michael Douglas doing virtual reality filing. He puts on a virtual reality gloves and helmet and goes into a virtual filing cabinet.
Yes, he does.
And it's amazing.
I'm now thinking about offices in space. We didn't mention Captain Picard, who is a great one. And talk about a view, seriously.
Yes.
But it's interesting about paper, isn't it? Because Star Trek, obviously, doesn't really have paper either. At least traditionally on TV, they have those little, essentially iPads, let's be honest. But Battlestar Galactica does, and what they do is they just clip the edges off the paper. Everything is eight-sided, have you noticed that? Not four-sided.
It's been a while since I saw Battlestar Galactica.
The good one, not the old one.
Oh, right. I'm going to mention one more Office, which is great, actually, just a couple, because I'm going through, as usual, the IMDb's list of the biggest films of all time. And I've just been reminded of M's Office. In Bond, which is, yes, Helen, but it's such an iconic office.
Q's
I love
office. Q's office. It's cool.
That's not an office. That's a workshop.
It's an office.
It's a workshop.
It's got staplers that have flames coming out of them and everything.
Is that what you need to put in an office?
It's just got a photocopier that blows people up.
A stapler that can kill you. And, of course, Frank Drebin's office and the Naked Gun. What an amazing
office.
It has everything. It has, you know, filing cabinets. It has the missing evidence in the Kellner case. My God, he was innocent. You know, it's
Frankie went to the chair 2 years ago.
Oh, such a film. And the best of the trilogy, I think Nick will agree. Ghostbusters Office, that's a good one.
Great office. Shut it down.
Could be here all day. And we didn't mention any TV shows, did we?
No. Well, apart from The West Wing at the beginning.
I would talk about CTU till the terrorist cows come home, but that's another podcast. They got amazing monitors.
Yeah.
Terrorist cows, another thing to be scared of. Jesus.
If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, send it in to us via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, send it in to us via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire podcast. Otherwise, chances are we won't see it because we're so wildly popular. You can Facebook us as well, Empire Magazine, and you can email us. podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, our first guest this week are the four main stars of an HBO sitcom which has finally made it into a movie. Nope, not that one. This is Entourage. Yes, the Mark Wahlberg produced show is breaking out this week on the big screen, and its original stars Adrian Grenier, Kevin Connolly, Kevin Dillon, and Jerry Ferrara, aka Vince E. Drama and Turtle, are back. They popped into our pod booth last week, all four of them at once. Chaos reigns, and they spoke to Ali Plum, who greeted them with a nice warm chat. Enjoy.
Could you tell me your name, the name of your character, and a bit about your character for the umpteenth time today? If you could just deliver a little bit about who you are, where you came from.
Shall I start?
Please.
Sure. Yes, you should.
Kevin Dillon. I play Johnny Drama Chase. And my character is a struggling actor who's got a more famous younger brother who... just finished a movie that his brother directed him in this movie. And he feels he did some of the best work of his career. He figures he figured out everything about acting and knows exactly how to do everything. And his career is going to go to the next level. Unfortunately, not everyone agrees. They want to cut him out of the film. And that's where he's at.
I'm Jerry Ferrara. I play Turtle, the very, very loyal sidekick slash driver to Vincent Chase. Over the years, he started off in the pilot, negotiating with girls to make out with him, and he'll show them where Vince eats breakfast in the morning, to basically getting into the octagon with Ronda Rousey to prove he wants to date her and doesn't have bad interests. So he's the ultimate sidekick. He thinks Vincent Chase is the biggest movie star on the planet, good or bad, high or low. And he's also loyal to the Eric character and the Johnny Drama character. This is his friends for life.
My name is Kevin Connolly. I play Eric E. Mad Dog Murphy.
E. Murph.
A New York transplant from Queens. Grew up with the guys and managing a Sbarro's pizza place. And Vince decides that he needs a little help navigating through his career, so he moves me out. Four guys navigating through the shark-infested waters of Hollywood together. Loyalty and friendship and standing by each other through thick and thin. And yeah, we all work for the big guy, Vincent Chase.
That would be me.
That would be you.
Adrian Grenier. I play Vincent, Vincenzo, Vincenzo
Chase. I like that, Vincenzo Chase.
He is the reason the Entourage exists. He got discovered off a Mentos commercial and was quickly swept to Hollywood and became very rich and famous and was able to finance the lifestyle of the Entourage. And
so, are you the reason the Entourage exists?
I mean, it's, you know, you didn't know that.
And I became very rich and famous.
Well, look, this is about the lifestyle, getting an inside glimpse, being part of the Entourage. These guys are so down to earth. They're working class guys who have been given an opportunity to live the spoils and riches of fame. And that's the fun part. But like Kevin was saying, it's really about how they bond together and support each other despite all of the toys and all of the spoils.
Can we just talk a little bit about shooting that Mentos commercial? Because it's amazing. You do the most amazing, pardon the expression, shit-eating grin, like straight to camera of, yeah!
Yeah.
How many takes?
You know, I couldn't
four
get
days.
Enough of that. I could not get enough. I had so much fun shooting that. Because, you know, it's one of those classic, you know, everybody knows what a Mentos commercial is, what it's like. And, you know, it was an honor to be able to, you know, break out my shit eating grin for a change.
The other funny thing about it, too, is, you know, it's been a story point from the show from the beginning. Mm. So to 8 years later, then go back and actually shoot the commercial.
How did they make you look so young? I
It was a funny. Payoff. It was funny. Yeah, it was a great payoff because, you know, again, we've been talking about it since season one, the Mentos commercial, and then, you know, in the movie, here we are, you know, shooting the commercials.
Finally, we've also got Gary Busey comes back. We're big fans of Gary Busey at Empire. We did this amazing feature with him where we went to his house, and it was odd. What is the weirdest thing he's ever said to you?
Come on, Kev, you got it, Kev.
It's gonna take up a lot of your podcast right here.
Yeah. One day we're on set and I just felt like he was staring at me. He was like kind of looking at me, you know. And I was doing that sort of thing where you're like kind of looking over your shoulders to see that hopefully he's staring at somebody else and there's nobody there. And I'm like, wow, he's staring at me. He's like Gary's a big guy, dude. He's a strong dude. And he comes over. He's like, Kevin, you and I are going to play a little game called Tickle and Pee. I was like, what's that, Gary? Well, I'm going to hold you down. I'm going to tickle you until you pee. I said, Gary, please don't do that. There's, you know, 150 crew members here. I'm 36 years old. Please don't hold me down and tickle me. Because I'm ticklish to boot, too. So I would have
worked.
I would have peed.
The key is just pee early and get it over with.
So there he is, like, chasing me and, like, running across the lawn, giggling, trying to get away from him, thinking, like, how long is he going to go along with this bit? And then he grabbed me and he, like, held me down and was tickling me. It was humiliating. It was just truly emasculating.
Just pouring water over your crotch going, look, it happens. Yeah. Let's move on.
You know, I saw him for Halloween in Malibu. I ran into him and he's like, hey, I'm hearing about the Entourage movie. Hey, are you guys going to bring me in? So I had to say, hey, Doug, what about Gary? You gonna get him in? And he's like, well, yeah, I guess we're gonna have to have Gary in there somewhere. But
I mean, it wouldn't be.
He was
it
wouldn't now. Be.
Oh, you gotta have
Gary Busey in
his
some
first
but
words.
But he's difficult to. I mean, he's a great guy, but he's kind of tricky.
His first
to work
words
with at times,
to
know?
Doug
he's
Allen.
So out there,
he said, "Doug, I'm not gonna give you your words. I'm gonna give you the truth." I mean, that's not a way to lead. I don't know many actors who could say that to a director and get away with it. But Gary's one of them. And the writer-director.
Just takes the script in front of him and just...
Basically, oh, yeah, you know, it's funny. There's talk about, like, people improvising, and it's like, at the end of the day, like, the show is very highly scripted, and there was not a lot of improv. The guy who probably did the most...
He's got the green light.
Was Gary Busey.
He's got the green light.
Because he just didn't ask permission. He just said whatever.
Can we talk a bit about... this is a bit left field. Viking Quest? Please?
Sure.
Tell me you have as a memento somewhere in your house. Because Viking Quest, listeners, hello, is the fictional TV show / movie series on cable that Drama's in, where he plays a Viking. No shit. So Do you have the massive gargantuan hat?
You know,
do you have any memorabilia at all?
This is a bummer because I wanted to buy it.
And, no.
They priced it because they knew the value of it at this stage. So they, you know, you'd think they would kind of give it to me at a good price, sure, being that I made it famous, kind of. Or
it's for your head.
And if they, I think they wanted over $5,000 for that.
Are
helmet.
You kidding
and
me?
I just can't. I can't pull the trigger.
I'll make you one for half.
Yeah, and any Viking hat that you wear will become valuable. So you should just buy some cheap ones. We'll start a business.
Thing, it's not even a Viking helmet. It's actually a samurai.
It is a samurai,
like a
helmet.
Samurai suit.
You know, Adrian, they gave him his Aquaman suit. They let Adrian keep his Aquaman suit.
When was the last time he wore
it? When was the last time he put on the Aquaman suit?
Dinosaur skull. And they made three of them. Remember when to a fight with Scotty Khan?
Dylan was like, don't you mess up this, because if we, you know,
if it breaks good the first time, they're going to just move on, and then I'll get to keep one, because Doug Ellen was going to keep the other. It's an Allosaurus replica, and it looked awesome.
That's why you treated that scene so important. I remember you were very
yeah. I was like, you guys really make a big deal
Kevin
about how perfect that
said,
break was.
I want you to go crazy about how much you love that take.
And everyone did. Everyone was like, "Oh, that was good. You're never going to get it better than that." And they said, "All right, let's move on.
I don't need another. Let's move. I won't do another."
The whole crew was talking about how great, how perfect the break was.
It was like broke into an applause at the end of the take. So Dylan have his dinosaur head.
I have a leather bound shooting script of Medin.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very nice.
Of course, there's no words in there. Right?
It's just I think it's an entourage script inside, okay. But still the outside says Medellin. It's, you know, branded on the leather.
That's cool. That's cool.
Can you top that? Anybody else top that? Because I think
Mementos, anyone?
Dinosaur skull is pretty great.
That's
pretty
cool. Hard
pretty
one
cool
be.
One.
Yeah.
I don't think I have anything. I have the. I mean, I have the sneakers that were made on the show.
Fugajamas.
Yeah. We. Those are. By the way, those are of real value.
We did an episode where the Vince character pays $20,000 for Turtle to get limited Nikes from this artist, and the actual one. We all have a pair, and I have the ones that were the camera one, like they were on camera in the episode that I have locked away because I've gotten some pretty insane offers for those the years. Yeah.
Well, they're super limited edition. I mean, I think they made like 8 or 9 pairs.
Right, a couple of spares.
Like, yeah, a few spare pairs, and they're all spares. Like labeled and all that kind of stuff. So we got a pair of those. Do you still have yours, Vinny?
I do not.
I don't want to tell you what happened. Mine got stolen. Then I found them on eBay.
Yeah,
I think I saw the guy selling them. Had like a bandana around his face, and I was like, "That's my tenant. That's one of my tenants."
Jeez,
your tenant stole it?
One of my tenants. It was the brother of one of my tenants.
The value of the shoes went up like crazy, crazy amounts of money. So none of us really knew how valuable they were at the time.
Still. I mean, you know, as an exchange, you get people on the street asking to hug it out like all the time, right? Does this happen a lot? Hug it out, bro.
I think Jeremy probably gets that more
than
anyone.
That.
Well,
I'm getting
you, maybe, because you get hugged out.
Of course you get hugged.
I don't get hug it out much.
Do you get victory?
I get victory constantly.
I get
once a day.
A
I'm
lot.
Not even kidding. I get victory once a day. Give me a victory. I rarely do a victory, but guys are doing it constantly.
It's a very special occasion that you bust out a victory.
And every once in a while, at the right moment.
Wow, if
do
he's
it.
In a good mood, he'll drop one.
Yes, I will.
And everyone talks to you with your character name, right? They just walk up to you and go, "Drama, could you help me? You know, tell me where the nearest tube station is." And
well,
that happens all
it's
the time.
Johnny or Drama or hey. Where's he? Where's Vince? They're at the mansion. They think it's all real.
The lines are blurred. But even for us, I mean,
where's Ari? He's at the agency.
We were doing an episode of WWE recently, and we were supposed to be playing ourselves. I couldn't stop calling Kevin Johnny.
It's weird to be shooting something and calling him.
Those are
him.
Some blurry lines. We wrestled.
Yeah,
we wrestled. So that was weird.
I felt like we did that 6 months ago. I mean, it's only two weeks ago.
Literally.
Crazy.
Speaking of which, what was it like all appearing on the Ellen sofa at once? Was that a trippy
experience?
I felt
like we were ambushed.
By Ellen.
With the game.
She had a couple questions we weren't expecting on it.
Yeah,
that was. Did you see that bit? It was pretty funny.
She threw us
under the bus, and like from the first question.
We played Never Have I Ever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it wasn't like Never Have I Ever went to a party. She opened up with like Never Have I Ever what? Like
had
slept
threesome.
Had a threesome. That was her opener.
If you ever had sex in your trailer, was one of the first questions.
You know, only from Ellen. That we could accept it coming from Ellen.
But well, just because it's daytime TV, you don't. I just didn't think that they
I
did
didn't
that.
I didn't see it coming.
Of all the episodes that you'd want people to look back on and say, you know what, could you just go and watch that last one? Because I really am proud of my work there. I just think it's really funny. for people who maybe watched a bit of Entourage or no Entourage, what episode stands out for you looking back?
I would go with the one where I get terrible reviews in five towns and I want to kill the reviewer who works at Variety or Hollywood Reporter. I forget which one.
Variety.
It's Variety. So I go into the office and I call him out. I'm going to beat him up. And it actually started off in a rub and tug and I end up over there. And then I get all bummed out. I think my career is over. I drive out to the Grand Canyon. You think he's going to drive his Lincoln off the Grand Canyon. And then wakes up in the morning and the guys call him up and say, hey, Five Towns is a hit. You're on a hit show. That to me was one
that
of the
was
best.
That was the great Johnny Drama episode.
That was a great
got
episode.
Got you nominated for
Emmy.
That
was a selfish episode for me to like that one the best. But
are we going around and doing this?
Oh, please. Yeah, yeah.
There's the finale of season two, which is where we all think Vince is going to quit Aquaman because he can't work with Mandy Moore. And then he's in a terrible fight with E. We're all from Johnny Drama and Turtle freezing him out because we think he's making a terrible decision. And he ends up doing the movie. And it ends with us driving off the lot of Paramount and the camera cranes up. It says Aquaman, summer of whatever the year was. And right. It goes out with that. I don't remember the name of the song. It's the same song that was like in Goodfellas. It just was a great. I just thought it was one of the greatest endings we ever did to an episode and a season.
Ian Vince were in a terrible fight.
Terrible fight.
I feel like we need some nostalgic schmaltzy music playing right here. Piano.
Honestly, there's different kind of levels to it. Like, you know, like Kevin said, I mean, I think we'll all have our episodes that we liked for ourselves, you know, our characters personally, but, you know, from a production standpoint, you know, we did some really cool things with the Sundance episode.
Sure.
Was just a great episode because nobody had done that before. Nobody knew what Sundance was. You know, that episode aired and I had 25 of my friends from Long Island calling me screaming, "We're going to Sundance. We want to go to Sundance."
Spring break.
Yeah,
Parks
exactly.
In Utah.
And you know, we did the same thing with Ken, and you know, so there were some really good achievements in production, but my favorite episode of all time is the welcome. It's called Welcome to the Jungle, and it's when we're actually shooting Medellin because we did different things. It was kind of like a mockumentary,
like Spinal
drama.
Tap.
It was it was just something different about it. And we were like on set, and we were like in the trenches, and Reese Corio is Billy Walsh. It was just so good. So that's my favorite episode to watch. And, you know, it's funny because that was the first episode of season four, and that season ends with us in with Cannes. The movie being a bomb in Cannes. So season four was always my favorite because then we also had these guys in furry outfits. And
yeah, I love the furry ones.
That was all season four.
And by the way, I liked that episode because I had a beard. I didn't have to shave.
Right.
And, you know, if you have a beard, as you do, and we all, as men, know how much it sucks to have to shave every day. But since we're being nostalgic, I'm just going to say, you know, the first pilot episode.
There we go.
You know, if you go back and you look at it, it's so scrappy.
So young.
We were literally scrapping it together. We didn't know what we were building. You know, we had a lot of conflicts. We're insecure about, you know, whether or not we were getting it right. And then when you look back, you just see there's so much heart, there's so much bonding and brotherhood and so much fun. And it's not the slickest of any of our episodes, but
we were definitely working out some kinks.
I'm surprised you said that. We still had a lot of issues. Yeah.
But he's right from a nostalgic standpoint.
I feel like
it was rough.
The first two weren't great.
It was like an indie film.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk about it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a pleasure. I think this is the last of the day, so go have a great day.
I'm going to go take a nap.
Nap time.
Nap time.
See you.
Entourage. Yeah, nap time.
Entourage.
Okay, it's time for some movie news now. What's on the movie agenda this week? Is there anything? What's happened?
Kenneth Branagh was in the news this week. He is reportedly in talks to make a new version of Murder on the Orient Express. Christie story, of course.
Yes.
The one that was previously made with all of the stars.
I just watched this completely randomly.
Really,
Phil bought this for me, £3 from FOP. Head down to FOP, buy this. And then, only hours later, this was announced.
The Albert Finney one.
The Albert Finney one.
You have power.
Phil has power.
Phil has power. Wow. So that was Albert Finney as Poirot. No word on who it would be this time. Hey, maybe Branagh himself.
Maybe Branagh himself.
Branagh.
I'd forgotten how eccentric Albert Finney is, because I'm so used to the David Suchet version that it's weird. He's so twitchy and weird and yelling out. He barely talks for the first hour of the film, and then he doesn't stop talking for the second. It's a weird film, but it's great. So many great people in it.
I seem to remember always preferring Peter Ustinov, actually, in terms of old Poirot's pre-Suchet.
Yep. I'll give you that.
But yeah, this seems like might be a kind of an interesting change for him. He's done a couple of like big action-y, effects-y movies recently, in which I actually surprisingly include Cinderella, which at least had effects, if not action. And this could be quite an interesting sort of a slight change of pace, but not so much. I mean, he has obviously done detective stories before. He's done Wallander on the small screen, that kind of thing. So he does have a little bit of a feel for the genre, I think.
Yeah, it's a strange one to do slightly for the reason that the ending is so famous. Well, I feel like it is anyway. I feel like everyone knows the ending to that film.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, thank goodness. So one person remains unspoiled.
So I feel like it's a slightly strange choice for the reason that the ending is so famous and everyone pretty much knows, you know, who done it. Yeah, it was Poirot.
Come on. No
but
way.
It's an all-star cast, and it's going to be fun seeing if Branagh manages to marshal the same kind of level of all-star cast.
Well, speaking of all-star cast, I'm going to read out the cast. Okay.
Do it.
All right, so okay. Albert Finney as Hercule Poirot. Okay. Lauren Bacall as Mrs. Hubbard. This is a Sidney Lumet film, by the way. Okay. Lauren Bacall as Mrs. Hubbard. Martin Balsam as Bianchi. Ingrid Bergman, taking a break from directing all the Swedish movies, as Greta. Jacqueline Bisset as Countess Andrény. Jean-Pierre Cassel as Pierre. That's typecasting, surely.
That's
come
stereotyping
on. Sean Connery as Colonel Arbuthnot.
He's very grumpy in this film.
Yes. Have you ever heard Sean Connery getting on a train? No, that's not too bad. John Gielgud as Beddoes. Anthony Perkins, Vanessa Redgrave, Richard Widmark, Michael York, the great Colin Blakely, all the way down to John Moffat as Chief Attendant. I mean, they just, even the small roles, they're just packed with power.
It's amazing.
I love it. It's a great film and a great story. And I can't believe Poirot does it at the end. That's amazing. That's huge. We wish all the best to Kenneth Branagh in his Sir Kenneth, in his efforts to make that movie.
It's been a long time since we've seen Poirot. Who should play Poirot? That's the big question, isn't it?
Well, that's Helen was saying. Could Branagh do it himself? I mean, it has to be. So, guy Branagh, in his 40s, 50s?
Maybe Patrick Stewart? Is he getting on a wee bit
too old? Is he too old? I think he's too old.
He'd be good, though. He's got the skull shape for it.
Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant, no.
No.
Kevin James. But he's on one of those little segues. He's just rolling up and down the train interrogating people.
Hercule Poirot, train cop.
Oh, gosh.
I'm in.
Please stop before you give Hollywood ideas.
Sorry.
That would be
don't
amazing.
Listen to us, Hollywood.
No, do listen to us, Hollywood. Kenneth Branagh directs Kevin James as Hercule Poirot.
Could Ian McKellen do it and do a Sherlock Holmes Hercule Poirot doubleheader?
Mr. Poirot.
So hang on, this is one of the ones where Poirot has his younger, taller assistant with him, isn't it?
Hastings.
Yes.
No.
Then forget I said anything and move on.
Hastings misses the train, presumably. I don't know, I'm making up. He's not mentioned in it.
Okay, fine.
Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant could have done that.
Well, I was actually thinking Kenneth Branagh and Tom Hiddleston, who made such a good double act in...
Now you're talking.
Yeah.
Now you're talking.
On
but
stage.
isn't Poirot meant to be quite a... not dumpy man, but like he's quite short.
Yeah, he's shorter.
He?
Yeah.
All right, so we got to look for someone who's short, presumably British.
Belgian.
So they can do the Belgian accent.
Andy Serkis could do a Poirot.
Okay. He could play the Orient Express as well. So if anyone has any ideas, because clearly we don't. I liked Hugh Grant. I thought it was a good suggestion.
Nah.
No?
No.
Okay. By the way, I'm Hugh Grant's agent. I don't know if anyone spotted that. I like the fact that there's clearly so little news this week that we spent 25 minutes discussing the murder on the Orient Express. Anything else? What's happening?
There's a couple of other little ones. Eli Roth is apparently going to make an adaptation of the giant shark book Meg.
Short for Megalodon.
Yes, which is an ancient prehistoric gigantus shark. I think is the technical name, actually. Gigantoshark. I've read the book. It's the most trashy of trashy books ever.
It's a Steve Alton, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's essentially Mosasaurus the movie.
Essentially. Wasn't the pitch for this? This has been knocking around Hollywood for years.
Yeah, this has been
years,
around for a long time.
And so I remember the pitch of this was that basically the idea was that it would start with a T-Rex walking along a beach, and you're going, oh, a T-Rex, that's pretty big, isn't it? And then this huge shark comes out of the water and eats the T-Rex whole and swallows it whole, and you're going, whoa.
This sounds familiar.
So yeah, this would be a step up in scope for Eli Roth, who's flirted with big pictures before. He was in talks at one point to direct the adaptation of Stephen King's Cell, which is obviously lots of post-apocalyptic stuff, big scope. Weirdly enough, he was also at one point, I think, going to direct a Baywatch movie.
Maybe this is a chance. Maybe there's some kind of crossover that could be done here.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's this other thing as well that he's been talking about for ages called Endangered Species, which he's always said is going to be his Jurassic Park, but he never really said what it is, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Mm.
But it's interesting because he's definitely getting back on the movie-making horse. Knock Knock, his fifth film, is out next week before his fourth film, The Green Inferno, will be out later
in
the year.
Here's the big problem with this film.
Okay, it's
stupid. We've had Shark Attack 3.
Yes.
Which is one of the great gigantic shark movies. I think we can all agree. Any Empire Forumites who were around a few years ago when they all went nuts for that will remember
one of the greatest
special experience it was. That chat up line lives in infamy, I think it's fair to say. I'm not even going to spoil it. Please.
Yeah, watch that film.
Watch that film just for that chat up line. You'll recognize it when you hear it.
It's a belter.
It is a belter.
I wonder if it's ever worked in anyone.
I can't imagine that it has. But we've got Shark Attack 3. We've had that. We've also had Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, which, if you remember, had a shark jumping out of the sea to bite an aeroplane.
Is that what that's from?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
and Sharknado.
Sharknado.
The second of which I actually watched, and it begins with the survivors of the original Sharknado in a plane. They're all traumatized from the first movie, and they're in a plane at whatever altitude, and sharks start attacking them because there's a Sharknado, it gets sillier from there. I quite enjoyed it.
Isn't Sharknado 3 in its way? Doesn't it have the Hoff?
Yes, indeed.
It does. Yeah. So anyway, what I'm saying is he will need really good storytelling, really good characters, and really good effects to lay those ghosts to rest. And a chat-up line that's better than Shark Attack 3.
Mm.
Lay those ghost sharks to rest.
Yes.
But I wonder if this is the Jurassic World effect that we're now starting to see. I mean, I don't know when this was. This obviously probably wasn't just greenlit, you know,
this week.
Yeah. But I wonder if, with Jurassic World having made all the money in the world already, whether people are going to start digging dinosaur scripts and things like that out there.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think this was rumoured this was a resurrected project about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think, but Eli's participation in it was only confirmed yesterday. So that's cool. But what's interesting is whether he goes, it's a question of tone, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, do you go full out ridiculousness and try and somehow out Sharknado, but with
no.
a bigger budget, obviously.
Let's hope not.
Or do you actually go down the route of this could genuinely be a great monster movie if we do it right?
Mm.
So, yeah, it could be Jaws on steroids.
I'd almost take a little bit of the early part of The Kraken Wakes, the great John Wyndham novel, if either of you have read that.
Yes.
For the kind of the slow build and the tension and the havoc that something sea-based can wreak.
Mm-hmm.
And if you started with that then and that slow build-up, then you might have something worth seeing.
That's the one with the aliens who
land in the deeps.
They're melting the ice, aren't they, trying to drown everyone.
Yeah. Eventually, that's their kind
it's
of like...
It's a great book.
Yeah, it's a really, really clever book. Really scary.
Indeed. In fact, I'd like to see an adaptation of that.
Yes.
Come on, Hollywood, get on it. But actually, Nick, what you mentioned there, Jurassic World's made all the money in the world, and that's probably something we should talk about as well, because I don't think anyone saw this coming. There are two box office stories this year that I don't think anyone has seen coming. One is, so far, the box office champ this year is Fast and Furious 7.
Mm.
I don't think for much longer. I think Avengers will overtake it, and maybe Jurassic World will overtake that as well. So that was a bit of a surprise.
I mean, we saw it coming, Chris.
We saw it coming, Helen. Obviously, I after it hit 1.5 billion, I was very wise to the fact, and I, because we knew it would be big.
Yeah.
But it's almost doubled the previous, movie in the franchise. But the second thing is Jurassic World, which this week broke all manner of records. It broke the it's the first film ever to make $500 million worldwide in its opening weekend, beating Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 by some considerable distance. And in the States, and I did not see this coming, it beat the Avengers 3-year standing record for the biggest opening weekend of all time with a $208 million haul, and that was actually revised upwards after initial estimates had it being the second biggest weekend of all time.
I think everybody had underestimated how much people love dinosaurs. The other thing I think they did really well is they timed their publicity push just right, because I remember I was in a cinema in the US 3 or 4 weeks ago, and a trailer for Jurassic World came on, and somebody behind me said afterwards, "I didn't know they were making another one. Cool." So there wasn't that much awareness 3 or 4 weeks ago, but then it built and crested really in a concentrated manner that actually just sort of pushed these figures, I think. So I think they did their timing really, really well.
Mm. It feels weirdly fresh, given that it's the fourth film in a franchise. I think that huge gap did work, and I think if this had come out straight after the third one, I don't think this would have happened. But yeah, I saw it yesterday afternoon in Milton Keynes, and it was a packed cinema and people were applauding at the end, which I don't maybe that happens all the time, Milton Keynes, maybe they're just really happy. Yeah, it's heading, I don't know where it's going to end up office wise, but it's
I'm guessing around the 1.5 actually. I think it's usually a triple of your opening weekend, but it may have great legs. I mean, it's got big, powerful T-Rex legs.
It's
so
got lovely big legs. Lovely big dino legs. Well, it's first, you know, and hello, Box Office Nerd here. It's fourth day. It's first Monday in the States. Also broke records. $25 million non-holiday weekend, non-holiday day Monday, which is phenomenal. So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what happens this week. It's going up against Pixar's Inside Out. Even if it drops 50 to 60%, it's probably still going to win the weekend, as they say. Yeah, this thing could be absolutely enormous. And in a way, we should have seen it coming. You can kind of look at The Lost World, Jurassic Park, and you can look at Jurassic Park 3 in particular, and the Law of Diminishing Returns. But Jurassic Park was the biggest film of all time.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, if you think back, if you can think back, because it's 22 years now, some people may not have been born, but if you do think back to that time, it was everywhere. It was a phenomenon. And it's probably no surprise that Jurassic World, which we think is a perfectly solid sequel, I know a lot of people don't agree with that. But I'm not surprised it's filled that vacuum.
But there's something to be said for patience, because originally this would have come out last summer, and Spielberg said it's not ready, we need to push it back a bit. And I think, you know, with so many big films now locked into dates before they've even written the script, I think there's something to be said for getting it right.
I think that I completely agree. There's a lot to be said for putting the film first and the release date second. Because I think what's happening more and more, actually, is you can see that if you have the right film, if you have a good enough film, the release date matters a bit less. You still need, a couple of weeks clear run, but you don't absolutely need to book it in 6 years in advance. You know, and if that makes for a worse film, then it's going to hurt your box office ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do wonder as well, is this perhaps a reaction to all the superhero films coming out? Does this feel like something that's just different from so many superhero movies?
There have been, let's say, 4 consistently per year for the last 8 years, maybe less, maybe let's say 6. That cumulatively feels like a lot because they take up so much publicity space, because they take up so much sort of cultural awareness.
I get all of that.
But I agree, you know, the absolute number is lower, but their cultural impact is bigger. So maybe that's an element of this feeling.
Yeah,
more
this,
different
as you know, this is a bugbear of mine. This perception that there's a tsunami, and it's coming. It is coming, especially now as DC and Warner Brothers are about to get into it big time. And if Fantastic Four is a success, Fox are going to step that up as well. And we already had 3 X-Men movies next year with New Mutants and Wolverine 2, and much more to come. But at the moment, as things stand, especially if you don't count Guardians of the Galaxy as a superhero film, which I personally don't, then we've had 1 in the last year. And since X-Men Days of Future Past, and that's Avengers Age of Ultron. So I can kind of see that, but at the same time, we're going to get a lot of dinosaur movies now as well. And in 3 years' time, we'll be going, oh, no, not another dinosaur movie.
I want saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths in the next Jurassic film. Come on, Woo.
I bet you
know what he's got in that case.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Come on, unleash the saber-toothed tigers.
Yeah.
Or goats. Because the goats just get eaten alive
in all these
films, and they need to get their payback.
I thought you meant saber-tooth goats, which was
you
do.
Anything's possible.
Okay. Wow. and certainly we know that Wu has no medical ethics and doesn't pay any attention to his animals once hatched.
Yeah, he'll put saber-tooth teeth on anything, yeah.
And if that means they can camouflage themselves as well, so be it.
Oh my God, guys. Lightsaber-tooth tigers. Oh my God.
Do you genuinely wonder if that's the direction the Jurassic franchise is going to take now that they've gone down this route of genetic
manipulation,
kind of hybrids and stuff?
You're seeing a crossover with Disney's Star Wars franchise.
I am now.
That's amazing.
Lightsaber dinosaurs.
Lightsaber, come on.
I would say one more thing about Jurassic World. I did the online preview of 2015 for the website, and now it looks pretty certain that at least two of my $1 billion club are going to be in the $1 billion club. Well, one already is, Avengers, obviously. Mm-hmm. Furious 7 already is, three. And it now looks like Jurassic World is pretty solid as well.
Mm. And this year as well, you'd imagine.
The Star Wars.
If Star Wars doesn't hit the $1 billion club, someone somewhere is getting fired.
Like mega fired, like none more fired. Like,
fired into space.
Yeah.
They'll be force choked and then fired. It'll be that bad. What else? What else could potentially hit
Spectre.
A billion?
Spectre
could hit a billion.
And the other two I named.
Okay.
Which are a little bit more iffy, quality dependent.
Right.
The final Hunger Games.
Yes.
They've been hovering around 800 and a bit. This is the final one.
And this one seems to have action rather than
people talking in a bunker.
Cabinets. Yeah.
I don't see it.
It could happen. I'm not guaranteeing that one. But
I don't
it could
feel
happen.
It. But I'm not. Maybe not the fan base, but I don't detect excitement. The last one was so boring.
Yes, it was.
It was set entirely in conference rooms.
But I would point out to you the case of the last two Harry Potters as well. There's a bump for the last one that you don't get for the second last.
Yeah.
It also happened with Twilight.
That's true, but doesn't the final Hunger Games book, from I've not read it, but from everything I've heard, is a bit of a disappointment in itself. So
it is, but maybe it'll work better on screen.
We'll see.
And then the final, again, slightly iffier prediction, but it's looking good from the trailers so far, is Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation.
Now that's a big leap.
It's a bigger leap, I
admit. That's okay. That's
what did the last one make?
600 million worldwide, roughly thereabouts. But that's I think, based on what we've seen, I think that's going to be the dark horse of summer in terms of it could be a really belting film.
Yeah.
I really hope it's good, because I think the trailer's fantastic. I think Chris McQuarrie's great. But I do wonder. And I do wonder if the larger Tom Cruise issue, I mean, Edge of Tomorrow was fantastic. Probably looking back on it, that may have been the best film of last summer, best blockbuster of last summer, and it just didn't do that well. And you wonder, is that because people don't like Cruise anymore, or what is that?
I think the problem with those films, the issue with those films perhaps, is that they're amazing set pieces with a kind of loose plot built around them, and you have to give those stunts away in the trailer. So I feel like we've seen the best stunts in the film. Maybe I'm wrong and there's tons more stuff.
I mean, I will admit that one is a bit more of a guess.
Yeah, I'd say.
But I just wouldn't rule it out, because I think it looks, what we've seen so far is really, really strong. That makes me want to go see it on the big screen a lot. So
I'm gonna throw two more into this.
But
obviously, given, I don't know whether anyone knows this, but Nick and I had a bet about box office this year, which I've already spectacularly lost, because I genuinely believe that this year we would see a film hit 2 billion. And we may still. I genuinely believe that Avengers Age of Ultron would hit the $2 billion dollar barrier out of the gate, becoming only the second movie to do so, straight out of the gate and without re-releases. And we had a bet that... What was the bet? Was it that... I bet that both...
You said it would... No, you said Age of Ultron would hit $2 billion, and I said it wouldn't.
And you said it...
£10,
as simple as that?
Yeah.
It wasn't something Star Wars?
Nope.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So it hasn't yet. Jurassic World, I don't know, can it do it? I don't know. But, you know, my box office reputation is dwindling rapidly. But what about animated movies? Inside Out? Minions? Could Minions...
Minions might... I mean, listen, the last Despicable Me 2 made 970 million. So it's not impossible to think that Minions, who are beloved by children all over the world. I saw a little kid today walk into school wearing a Team Minions cap.
Wow.
It said, it's not impossible that could match that. I don't know. It's certainly not going to make $2 billion, but I wouldn't be entirely surprised if it got close to one.
Indeed. And Inside Out, you never know.
Inside Out looks like having the quality factor on its side. That may give it hugely long legs. I don't see it being a massive opening weekend, though.
So there's not a lot of news out there, which is a good thing. It's a very good thing, and I'll tell you why it's a good thing. It's because we are recording a live podcast, our third live podcast, this Sunday in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh International Film Festival, this Sunday, 21st of June, summer solstice, longest day of the year. We will be in our druid robes if anyone wants to come out and check it out. It's going to be full on Wicker Man. It's going to be amazing. Do come along to that. We're going to be at the Film House One, Sunday, 21st of June, Film House One in Edinburgh. For 2 hours, we've got some really, really cracking guests as well. Emily Mortimer's going to be there. Robert Sheehan's going to be there. He's always fun. And Corin Hardy, the director of forthcoming horror film The Hallow, but also The Crow remake, is going to be there. I'm going to try and get him to spill in that. And Jack Huston, by the way, dropped out of that this week. So that's...
Oh, interesting.
There's something to talk about as well.
We'll be coming back to him a little bit later.
We will?
Mm-hmm.
We will.
Jack Huston, we have a problem. That literally doesn't mean anything. Sorry.
So we're going to be at the we're going to be up in Edinburgh this week, recording it on Sunday. So do come along to that. Tickets are available via the Edinburgh Film Festival website, or just £5 a pop, which is an absolute bargain. There's going to be loads of spot prizes and stuff. It's going to be great, great fun. That podcast is then going to go up next Friday, as per tradition. So you know, but it means we have 5 days in between Sunday and Friday. So if Hollywood could just stop making news, but if they could make a lot of news between now and Sunday,
okay,
that would be brilliant. You know, like, announce all your Star Wars sequels, announce Spider-Man, announce all that stuff, so we have something to talk about on stage on Sunday. That'd be brilliant. But we'd love to see you there. It was great fun last year, so do come along to that as well. And we should also mention as well our Jurassic World spoiler special with Colin Trevorrow. Okay, time now for our second guest. This is a man who's one of our favourite actors, he's one of our favourite Knights of the Realm, and he's one of our favourite people. He is, of course, Gandalf, Magneto, and now Sherlock Holmes in Mr. Holmes, Get Over It. It's Ian McKellen, and he was talking to our resident Holmes nut, although Nick is also a Holmes nut, Ali Plum, about a whole ton of Sherlock stuff, from playing two different ages. He's 93 in the main part of the film, and then you flash back to him as a younger Holmes as well. There's also stuff about his forthcoming live TV movie with Anthony Hopkins, The Dresser, and just stuff about reuniting with Bill Condon, his Gods and Monsters director, on Mr. Holmes, and of course, the secret art of beekeeping, which plays a huge part in Mr. Holmes. Do enjoy.
I was lucky enough to be on set very briefly.
Oh, were you? Yes.
Yeah, very lucky.
Where was that?
Winchelsea.
Yes, Winchelsea, that's right. Yes.
And I discovered on set that your prosthetic nose, yep, as the older Sherlock Holmes, had a nickname, and the nickname was Shirley.
The pause is that I couldn't remember that, but it sounds likely. Shirley, we called it Shirley, did we?
Yeah.
All right.
The makeup artist was very pleased with that nickname.
Dave, well, Dave Elsie, I mean, is a genius, and I was very, very pleased with that makeup, nose included, mainly because it didn't take more than 45 minutes to put on.
Was it pretty odd to see for the first time what you possibly could in another universe look like at 93?
Well, I have played older men in the past, and the funny thing is, if you look at the early photographs of Gandalf when we were filming in 2000, actually, he's got quite a youthful complexion, and although I was covered in makeup. So I wonder how absolutely convincing these old makeups are. But I did think Dave Elsie for Mr. Holmes pulled something remarkable off on that, by stretching my skin and making it look very wrinkled. And I thought, looking at myself, it was very helpful to think, now I must make my voice a bit wrinkled, and I must make the rest of my body a bit wrinkled. So it was very helpful. But will I look like that? Yes, I probably will, because I reminded myself of my grandfather, when he was only 84 then.
What was your reaction when Bill Condon first said to you, I'd like you to play both a 63-year-old and a 93-year-old of the most iconic character in British literature, possibly?
Dream job, isn't it? Really? Ah, okay. Because it was directed by Bill. I mean, if Bill had sent any script, I would have wanted to do it. And he has just sent me another one. I'm doing it now. Beauty and the Beast, Disney. So, yeah. Oh, Sherlock Holmes. That's a wheeze. A lot of other people have played Sherlock Holmes and done it rather well. Maybe I can join the number. I mean, hundreds of actors. And then when I started reading this, I rather underestimated the script, actually. I thought the intrigue was going to be, what was it that happened? Will he be able to remember? And will he solve that last case that has somehow been in abeyance for 30 years while he's been in retirement. And then it turns out, the film turns out to be about something more general than that.
And bees, of course.
Oh, and bees, yes. Lovely bees, yes.
Yeah, you became reasonably, well, friendlier with bees than you were before.
I'd never had anything to do with bees. Mm. I'd never been stung by one. Kept a wary distance, and that is the best way, because they're going about their business. They're busy, of course, because they're bees. And they're making honey, and they don't need you to stand in the way of their flight path. And if you don't do that, and you've got a bit of smoke to hand to keep them calmed down, you're going to be fine. And no bee was harmed making this film, and no human was harmed by a bee. So we're all very mutually grateful to each other.
Great co-star.
And they were well looked after. And you see, the hives were placed down there on our location for a couple of months. They got used to living there. So when we arrived to do a bit of filming, all we had to do is be respectful.
Mm. Now, you shot some of this film in studio at a 3 Mill studio, which isn't too far away from The Grape.
Yes.
What's a Ian McKellen rap party look like?
Well, a rap party is just saying thank you to each other and goodbye and hope to see you soon. People are in the good mood and in slightly sad mood, I suppose, to be saying goodbye. So it was that sort of party.
You're not tempted to have a Sherlock pub quiz down at The Grape anytime soon?
Ah, well, the quiz in The Grapes is every Monday night, and I'm usually there, and there hasn't been any Sherlock questions that I can remember, and probably should be. I mean, Limehouse, which is where The Grapes is an area that Sherlock Holmes knew well. We talk about him as if he's a real person. I think that's what's intriguing about him. People do, you know, he's, after all, he's got his statue in Baker Street. Of course he's real.
You mention Beauty and the Beast. Mm. I was wondering, again, in that instance, what did Bill ask you to work on before you took on the role?
Since we made Gods and Monsters in 30 years ago, is it? I don't know. We've been good friends, so I've known usually what's coming up next for him. And there have been movies that he's made, and I wondered whether I was going to be asked to be in them. And so I think I knew about Mr. Holmes before he asked me to do it. And I certainly knew about Beauty and the Beast before he asked me to play Cogsworth, the majordomo who's turned into an animated clock for much of the film. So it wasn't altogether a surprise.
It's a total coincidence, but on TV just this weekend, Last Action Hero was on the TV, and I was watching it, and suddenly Death's Scythe came out of the screen.
Yes.
And again, I was wondering,
who was that? No.
Could that be... It is Ian McKellen. There it is. Have you ever been caught out by watching yourself on screen? Have you ever gone, I think I'm in this?
Do sometimes turn on, say, Wolf Hall and think, when do I come on? And a number of us actors who appear in those sort of things think, why did we get overlooked this time?
This seems like a me role. Oh, it's not me. With Beauty and the Beast, just to go back, how do you act as a clock?
Well, you don't. The clock's all been done for you. The people who are doing the acting there are the animators, and these days, animators go to acting school, you know. They're told to really get inside their parts. But I suppose in an ideal world, I would be consulted about the clock more than I was. But Beauty and the Beast is a film that already exists, and I thought it's apparently too much for the audience to imagine a Cogsworth who looks different from the original. So I'm rather having to match my performance to the clock than the other way around. Be our guest. Kevin Kline is playing grandfather, and all the other parts are taken, I think.
My friend asked me to ask you about working with Anthony Hopkins again.
Yes. Again, I've never worked with him before.
Ah, but I think you've kind of swapped roles a few times. I think you have both been up for roles that you've taken or he's taken.
Is that right?
Is it a pleasure to be working with him? Because he is the Anthony Hopkins.
The reason I wanted to do The Dresser, a play which has had many manifestations, including a very successful film with Tom Courtney and Albert Finney, whenever I've been asked to do it on stage, I thought this belonged to other actors. But when Anthony Hopkins was going to play the old actor and I was being offered The Dresser, which was another way around of looking at it, I immediately said yes, simply to work with him. Of actors of my generation, he's way up there, isn't he? And I'm glad I did. We all had a wonderful time, and a brilliant cast with the Sarah Lancashire and Emily Watson.
I gather he's quite fun on set.
Far too much fun on set. Far too many stories. But Anthony tells stories, but they're not the sort of stories most of us tell, you know, our favourite stories. Now, he just has a memory that can alight on almost any episode in his life, and he can fill it out with amazing detail. Mm-hmm. He's an astonishing memory. And he was in the company of people who were of an age to know what he was talking about when he referred to early radio programs that he'd known as a kid or his wartime experiences. And he was on fine form. And I hope we get to work together again. It's a very good outcome. It's a very good film.
I'm glad to hear it.
Well, not film. It's a televised play. Don't see that very much on TV these days.
It's a rare treat, yeah. And finally, this X-Men Apocalypse movie, is that something you'd in any way be involved with? Or is that long gone for you now? Is that world's past?
Are you talking about the film that's currently being made?
Yeah.
There were hints that I was going to be involved. And then I was told definitely I wouldn't. And then I heard that Patrick Stewart was in it. And I thought, well, he has got a good agent. But actually, he's got the same agent as I had, so I got even more paranoid. But apparently he's not in it. So Michael Fassbender, is it? I don't know. Seems to have taken over the role. He's a bit greedy. I think he's got these three films coming out this year. I don't know. You'd think he'd throw the crumbs to the old boys, but no manners.
I think you need his agent.
Yes, that's right. So, well, but you know, X-Men goes through many manifestations in the comics on which these films are based. Things are always changing. You swing between the present and the past and the future, and that's what they're doing in making the film. So I don't give up hope, but at the moment, my Magneto is no more.
Oh, well, real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ah, oh, what a delight.
Isn't he, though?
What a delight. Yeah, no, he's great. Let's start the review section of the podcast with Mr. Holmes. Let's do that. Let's talk about Mr. Holmes.
This is mostly set in 1947 with a very elderly Sherlock Holmes who's retired to the Sussex coast to raise bees. That is canon, by the way. That is what he's supposed to have done after he stopped detecting. And he's obviously in his 90s by that point. He's extremely elderly, still fairly hale. He's just returned from Japan, where he went on a trip looking for some mind-boosting medicine, essentially. But he is beginning to... His memory is beginning to fail him. And obviously, you know, given that he is Sherlock Holmes, this is an extremely upsetting and difficult thing to deal with. And one of the things that he can't really quite remember is his final case. And we flash back to about 1919, which is when he took this this young couple's case. The husband believed the wife was lying to him and was trying to find out why. And there were certain mysterious aspects that kind of piqued Holmes' interest. But he doesn't remember quite what went wrong. He knows he must have failed because after that he exiled himself to the country. But he doesn't know why. And he's trying to kind of remember and piece it together. That's basically the plot. You have Laura Linney as well as his housekeeper, who is who's kind of uneducated, doesn't really understand him, doesn't really know much about him, is just trying to get on with her life, thanks very much. Her young son, Milo Parker, Milo Parker plays him, his name's Roger, who's great, and he kind of strikes up a little friendship with Holmes. And it's basically an old man trying to unravel the secrets of his own past, which he's begun to forget. I think it's fair to say. As you'd expect, really good performances, but maybe not a lot of propulsion to this. There's no real sense of urgency.
It's a mood piece.
Yeah, it is. And it's about aging, it's about getting older, it's about letting go of life. And as such, it's quite good, but it as a Holmes piece, it's a little odd.
I had the same kind of problem. I really am quite a big Sherlock Holmes nut as well. And part of me just wanted to see a more traditional, Ian McKellen playing a more traditional kind of Holmes, which he actually did via an audiobook last year. He read The Valley of Fear, and he introduced the screening of this that I went to, and he was saying then that he had a bit of trouble doing all the voices because he had to juggle all the American accents and stuff. But he is very good. It just doesn't feel a lot like Sherlock Holmes to me, and there's a few clever allusions and things, but
Yeah.
I was a little bit disappointed. It just felt like this could have been a film about another guy.
Yeah, it just feels like a nice character drama that has very little to do with Holmes. I would say, if it were up to me and I were making a film about old retired Sherlock Holmes, I would have made Michael Chabon's The Final Solution, which is, and that sounds like it's in terrible taste, that title, but it's both a play on The Final Problem, which was the one where Holmes died, and it's also obviously a play on the Holocaust, and the premise of that film is that a sort of a catatonic boy turns up in Sussex, and this old man, who isn't named in it, in the book, but starts investigating what happened to him and why he has these numbers. Yep. This bird that recites these numbers. And the kind of the premise of the book is basically that even Holmes can't solve the Holocaust.
Oh.
Mm. And it's a much more interesting book.
I would have liked to have seen a film in which an OAP Moriarty comes back from the dead and they're just chasing each other around on Zimmer frames. But that's just me. But Neil Gaiman famously made the joke that Professor Moriarty retired to Essex to raise wasps, which is genius. I mean, it is a good film. The acting is very strong. Laura Linney's accent has got drawn some ire. Mm.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah,
but I see what you mean. There were moments where the intonation was slightly off, but generally I thought it was really strong.
That accent's been made. It didn't bother me so much, but quite a few of the reviews have kind of mentioned it. It's very poignant. It's very sad. It's very melancholy. Maybe part of it is that in the books, Conan Doyle's books, Sherlock Holmes is not really an emotional character at all. He doesn't have any of that side to him. So suddenly seeing this very emotional story about him feels a bit weird.
I liked it. I liked that it sidestepped the problem of Holmes being a little bit more emotional or a bit more openly emotional by basically saying, well, this is Holmes telling his story now. That Watson is not a part of this. And Watson, you know,
fictionalized.
His stories, yeah, fictionalized things and held certain things back. And I really like this film. I like this film more than the official Empire rating. I think for me, this is a real Sunday afternoon soak of a film. Mm. And it's not that long either. Soak implies length. But it felt for me something that you can sit on your sofa of a Sunday afternoon, close the curtains and just revel in these great performances. And I really liked the bond between Holmes and young Roger, which is very, very nice. It's a really gentle film. Mm. It really doesn't go anywhere particularly.
And certainly not fast.
I'd use the word slight.
Because it's based, again, as we should mention, on the novel A Slight Trick of the Mind by Midge Cullen. But yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was a really nice... And there's some really, really nice things about it. I liked the flashbacks to the more sure Holmes of when he's in his 70s and he's going about his business. And there's a lovely little touch. At one point, he goes to see a film adaptation of one of his most famous cases. And the actor playing Sherlock Holmes in that film within the film is Nicholas Rowe, who played, of course, young Sherlock Holmes. And I just thought it was a really, really nice touch. And it's, you know, it's comfortable with its Holmes knowledge and it's comfortable with its Holmes lore. And it does change some things from the book as well, which is nice. Yeah, I liked it.
It would make a very good double bill with young Sherlock Holmes. Just play those back to back.
Yeah. That would be great.
It would. Yeah, perfectly pleasant film for me. But we gave it 3 stars, which, as we always say on the podcast, is, of course, a recommendation. Speaking of 3-star recommendations, Entourage the movie is out this week.
Yes, it is. I watched all 96 episodes of Entourage not too long ago for a new feature called Crib Sheet in our magazine. Mm-hmm. That was an experience. 96 episodes in a week, so maybe I was a little bit entouraged out. But there's kind of a bit of a decline in the show. It starts off very strong, very good cameos, people like James Cameron and... lots and lots of big names, and it's very much about the movie industry. It's very smart satire. And for me, and I know quite a few other people, it goes downhill as it becomes more of a soap opera and it becomes much more about these guys and their various relationships, which never really amount to too much for me anyway. I was hoping the movie would be more of a return to the industry stuff, and it's not really. It's much more of a kind of soap opera. Vince, the main character, got married at the end of the season and the film picks up and he's divorced. And so it just unpicks everything that the show finished on. For me, it just felt like it was treading water a little bit and going back over old storylines we'd already seen. How did you feel, Helen?
I was pretty negative on it, to be honest. I dipped in and out of the show. I was never a crazy huge fan, which may be why I'm quite so lukewarm. But at the same time, it's not a brilliant set of characters. As they're presented here, they are not that interesting. There is no subplot for Vince really at all. Nothing. All we're told is he's directed this film. Oh, and it's great. So he's a first-time director. He's had everything handed to him on a plate, and he's apparently knocked it out of the park. That's it. That's his storyline. Nothing else.
You don't get to see him directing the film because the old seasons of Entourage, they would actually have a season where he was making a film and they'd have stuff happening on set and the actors he would have been working with. I think that stuff would have been quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And it needed more of that. There was a storyline for Johnny Drama which was cut because Channing Tatum was going to be in the film and Johnny Drama was going to be appearing in Magic Mike, the new Magic Mike film, as a stripper. And it needed more of that kind of stuff. It needed to feel more like it was linked into Hollywood as it is now.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's Hollywood at all anymore because literally everything we're told about this film, you know, even from our perspective, not being terribly connected to the film industry in the sense of being in Hollywood, but it doesn't ring true like the Sex and the City movies in the sense that there was a show that had an idea that had real meat to its relationships and that got stripped away for the movie version and they just focused on the outside glitz.
On the plus side, there are a few good cameos. Piers Morgan is not one of them, but Liam Neeson appears. I don't think it's a spoiler to reveal some of this stuff because there was a trailer which just literally listed every cameo in the film. Liam Neeson turns up very briefly, and the Jeremy Piven's Ari has a great line shouted at him. And Jeremy Piven is probably the best in terms of the ensemble, as he was in the show. He's entertaining throughout. He's very angry. He's very stressed. You know, you've kind of seen him do it before, but it's fun to see him do it on the big screen. It's fine. It just could have been a lot better, I think. I will say one thing that confused the hell out of me was the timeline of this film. I couldn't figure it out. It picks up just after the final season of the show, so however many years ago that was. But there's a billboard for The Jinx, which is a brand new HBO show which just aired this year. And at one point, they bump into Mark Wahlberg, who's coming out of an ADR session for Ted Free. I'm pretty sure he says Ted Free.
He does,
yeah. I wrote it down.
Yeah, he does.
So is this film happening in the past, the present, or the future, or all three simultaneously?
Oh, it's like, does it happen in the Tesseract? Is that where it takes place?
That really confused me. And if anyone can figure out what year this film is set, please let me know.
The greatest minds of our time have been tasked with the challenge. This is going to be fun to see what happens. So we gave Entourage 3 stars. Any Piers Morgan completists out there?
Sorry. Something in my throat.
He is in it a lot. He's in it way too much.
Well, in his ongoing... Someone said... because he... On Twitter this week, someone said, oh, it's, you know, it's a cameo. And he went, no, it's a part.
He was bragging to John Cleese. He was... A couple of weeks ago, he was in a Twitter spat with John Cleese. And he said, which of us has got a number one movie coming out? I will say this. You know, if you loved Entourage and you enjoyed it all the way up to the end of the HBO series, you'll enjoy this.
What if, like me, you stopped watching Entourage after 4 episodes because everyone in the show was just unspeakably awful? 3 stars for Entourage, Len. And the last film we're going to discuss this week. Hey, Helen.
Hey.
You're going to love this.
Am
I? It's a Nicholas Sparks adaptation.
Oh.
The Longest Ride. Starring Scott Eastwood. You okay over there? You
I'm
all right?
Fine, no.
Okay.
No, this is, yes, I always enjoy another chance to see the Nicholas Sparks formula. I mean... put
he
on the
really
screen.
Is an auteur.
He really is. The 10th Nicholas Sparks film, believe it or not. And this one stars, you won't believe it, 2 really good-looking white people in North Carolina. I know, it
no
seems
way.
Impossible. And yet here we are. They're played by Britt Robertson, who you recently saw, of course, in Tomorrowland. Well, most people didn't, but some people did. I'm sorry,
come
that was mean.
On, come
anyway,
on.
And Scott Eastwood, who is preposterously handsome.
Clint's son,
yes.
Yeah.
But like makes his dad in his young days look, you know, mildly okay looking.
No, his dad in his younger days was pretty special as
yes,
well.
Yes, I know. And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He's better looking than that.
You're saying that?
I am.
That's a big statement.
I'm not saying he's more attractive. I'm just saying he's better looking.
He is a manly man.
Yeah.
You know, chiseled out of pure granite.
Very nice of you to say, Chris.
Sorry, I forgot you were still in the room, Nick. Scott Eastwood then.
Yeah, so he's a bull rider. She's an arts student in college. The two of them have an instant spark of attraction, but he's all like, you know, bull riding. And she's all, I must go to New York for an internship in art.
This is amazing.
It's already amazing. So then they rescue an old man who's run off the road, and it turns out that he's Alan Alda, but he used to be Jack Houston. I told you we'd come back to Jack
Whoa,
Houston.
Whoa, stop a second. Stop, okay. Stop. Okay.
So they pick up an old man.
Yes.
Who turns out to be Alan Alda.
Yes.
Please tell me he's actually Alan Alda in the film. And then, so he was formerly, he was formerly Jack Houston.
Yes.
How do we know he was formerly Jack Houston? Do we see flashbacks with Jack Houston? Who's also a very handsome chap. So this movie has a preponderance of handsomeness already.
I mean, yeah, he's not. He's no Scott Eastwood, is he?
So in terms of the sort of Hollywood dynasties, you're more in Team Eastwood than you are in Team Houston.
I mean, in terms of just handsome, sure.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So anyway, I feel like we're losing the thread slightly. Alan Alda flashes back to his days as Jack Houston when he was in love with Una Chaplin. And they
a chaplain as well?
I know.
Hang on a second. This is crazy.
I'm not entirely sure if she's one of those chaplains.
She is one of those chaplains.
Yeah, okay, so yes, all of the dynasties, basically, and Britt Robertson.
Is Britt Robertson related to anybody?
Not that I know of, but I feel like we should look into it.
Cliff Robertson. She's his great niece.
Yes, okay. Great niece of Cliff Robertson. So, they're all torn about whether to stay together, given that she's moving to the city and he's staying in the country, on one hand. Then, Alan Alda's all mourning his wife and flashing back to their whole story, but on the other hand. And the
we're
two
both
stories.
Crying here, by the
well,
way.
Exactly. Sorry. As you should be, because somebody's going to die at the end. Yeah, no, you know it. That's a part of the formula. It has to happen.
Is there anything we can do to stop it?
You could leave the cinema halfway through.
What if we don't go into the cinema in the first place?
He's still going to die.
Okay. So, is it he?
Or is it?
Oh, okay.
There's only one thing I want to know, Helen.
Sure.
Is there a ghost? Is there a lady ghost again in this one?
sadly, no. I think if any of you have seen Safe Haven, you will know that that is the best twist in any Sparks book to date. And I use the term really loosely.
Does anyone walk on the beach looking windswept and forlorn in this movie?
No, actually they don't.
See?
There's a lot of walking in the rain in these movies. I've never seen one, I'll be honest, but I've heard about them. And
Let's see, people do look forlorn, for sure.
Okay.
I just don't remember them doing it on the beach.
Does anyone say at any point, "You're tearing me apart"?
With their eyes, they say that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of giggling at the screening I went to, I'll be honest. Like, a lot. And there is a scene of people running along the beach in the surf, you know, throwing each other around into the water and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So I feel like that should count for something.
But they don't take out passers-by like a Naked Gun.
No, they don't, sadly.
Okay.
So The Longest Ride.
So The Longest Ride.
What does that refer to, that title? Is that the show-stopping 12.5-minute-long sex scene? Or what is that? It's because he's a bull rider, right?
He's a bull rider. So it works on like at least one level. It's a crowbarred in line.
At most one level, I think.
It's a crowbarred in line that Alan Alda says from one of his letters. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. Okay. Unless we use it in the Irish sense.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Filth.
So, I mean, listen, if you like Nicholas Sparks, it's fine. If you don't like Nicholas Sparks, obviously stay far, far away.
Okay.
It's not as Sparksy as Dear John, which I think is like peak Sparks, but it's not as ludicrous as Safe Haven.
3 stars because what the hell, why not? But also, you know, if you are Nicholas Sparks, then give a 5. Why not? And if you are not Nicholas Sparks, then it may not be a 3. Also out this week, but we haven't seen it in the pub booth, but also out this week is a real oddity called Accidental Love, which is lost David O. Russell film called Nailed. I don't know if you know this story, but a few years ago, he started to make a film called Nailed with Jessica Biel and Jake Gyllenhaal. And then, weirdly, because it's David O. Russell, funding ran out for a number of reasons, roughly about halfway to two-thirds of the way through the shoot. And so the film got shelved. And then he went on and he started, you know, doing all his Oscar stuff with American Hustle and Silver Linings Playbook, and he never came back to the film. He never got the funding to finish the film. But someone has now finished the film, and David O. Russell is not credited as a director in this one. What's his name in this one, Nick?
Stephen Green.
Stephen Green. Okay, thanks, Nick. Your voice is so high. Stephen Green, so it's the new Alan Smithy, and the film has been somehow finished and cobbled together and is, by all reports, dreadful. We gave it 1 star, which is not a recommendation, but there you go. Check it out if you want to see a real curio that I think David Russell would rather you didn't see. So there you go. It is what it is. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more formulated fun. We'll have the recording of our live show from the Edinburgh Film Festival. Again, if you live in and around Scotland, do come up and see us. It's going to be a lot of fun. Emily Mortimer, Robert Sheehan, Corin Hardy, live studio audience. It's going to be fantastic. Until then, it's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to agree with my cock.
Stop reading Grey, Chris.
I can't stop it. You know, if I start, it's like Pringles, isn't it? If I start, I won't be able to stop. So maybe I shouldn't start at all.
But safest.
It is for the best. See you next week. Thanks.